Hello, and welcome to the Green Team of the Legendarium, the weird little spinoff podcast of the Legendarium where patrons get together to discuss the books and topics the main crew hasn't gotten around to yet. I'm Little Red Book, and tonight I have with me Kipton.
Heyo.
And I have with me Spook.
Hello.
And I have with me Stormrunner.
Hey, how's it going?
Tonight we will be discussing Sabriel, the 1995 novel by Garth Nix. So, on a scale of 1 to 5, how would you rate this book?
I'll go. I've read this book a lot, and I think it's about a 4. A lot of that rating isn't necessarily related to the plot itself, but mostly to the world building and the details and character work that comes up. He's an expert at making characters out of a small number of lines. I'll say that. The little bit characters and side pieces and all the little soldiers, etc. I quite enjoyed them.
Yeah. What about you, Stormrunner?
Probably a 3.5-ish. I could be talked up or down on that depending on the context. I liked the characters fine. I didn't think they were particularly deep other than Sabriel. But it's a fun, what I would say is, I'm sure we'll get into this, a fun YA novel with some fun fantasy world building.
Okay, Spook, your turn.
Yeah, I also gave it a 3.5. I think overall the book is great. It was a lot of fun to read. I just think the scope that he was trying to capture didn't quite fit the amount of pages he gave himself to write the book. I think I would have rather had a bit more longer to sit with each character. I do think the characters were well written, but I think they would have been even better written if we had more time with them. And same with the places. It felt like we were kind of hopping from place to place without really having time to know what the places were, basically.
I think that's fair. I would also give it a 4, but it's also hard because, like Kipton, I've read this book many times, and so it's hard for me to... And I also have read the other books. So does that make sense? Like, I have a hard time separating it from the trilogy. I mean, I like the characters. I have only one major problem with the characters, which we will get into later. how do you feel about the contrast between Ancestral Air and the Old Kingdom?
Like, Ancestral?
Whatever. I can't say words. We all know this. Like, there's this whole tech versus magic trope. And how do you guys feel about that trope and how it's played out in this book?
I personally wish we got more information on it. I think it was kind of like this is a thing. Here's the clear dividing line between these two places, and then move on. I kind of want more history with it. Like, oh, what happened? What caused it? Has it always been there? How did people discover that there was kind of this geographic split between the two? How many people really travel between the two places? Just kind of different stuff like that that I would have liked more into. But I think as for the basics, I like it. And it makes sense with kind of how a lot of other fantasy books do it as well, where it's like this thing stops working when you're in this area, but then it stops working, you know, vice versa. So.
Yeah, I would generally agree with that. I'd like the idea. I think it's cool when we see it. Without getting into spoilers in the beginning and certain parts towards the end in particular, it pops up. But I feel like for a lot of the book, it's not really something that's explored just because that's not, because of where we are,
yeah,
like, you know, on the map, so to speak. That's not something that's going to come up in Sabriel's quest.
For sure, yeah.
But I would have liked a little more, like, show don't tell, like, the examples of that interaction between the tech and the magic, but I do really like the idea, and it's cool when we see it.
I like the idea that the worlds have two different, like, foundational aspects. One is a magic world, and one is a mundane technological world. And at the border, these two things meet, and there's some crazy stuff that happens in that border area. But for the most part, it's entirely another world, not a bordering country.
Yeah.
Right. And you find out a lot more about the history and whatnot later in the series.
the idea of a fantasy world where you can't just be like, oh, I'm going to make a machine that's going to automate whatever,
mm-hmm.
runs very counter to a bunch of isekai anime that I've been watching recently.
I'm not sticking that to go.
I know you're talking about.
I just find it weird that so much fantasy, like Robert Asprin has this joke in one of his books about how there's only like one dimension where magic and technology exist. And like, just that idea, I think it's fun to play with, I guess, in this story, but it's just a weird trope to me that you can't have technology and magic. Like, you can't have both. So I don't know. I have feelings like just general, why? Why is that the case?
This is why I like a lot of stuff that, say, like the Final Fantasy video game series does, just because that the Magitek aesthetic is very cool. I think it's used a lot. That conflict is used a lot because it creates inherent conflicts that the characters have to deal with, which may or may not be lazy depending on how it's written.
Right.
But in this case, I think it works.
Yeah, I think it kind of, it gives an explanation to why you can't bring guns or use guns. It's like, oh, because they don't work. So I think it's kind of a, like, I don't want to explain like why guns aren't in the story, so I'll just say guns don't work. And I think it's a simple explanation that just works.
Okay, that's fair, I guess. Yeah. How do we feel about animal companions in stories?
And the extent to which this is an animal companion.
Quotations.
I quite enjoy animal companions in general.
I mean, I read Anne McCaffrey. What do you think?
I personally have an animal companion, so I'm good with it.
I mean, I like animal companions in books. It's not something I particularly look for, but it's fun when it's there. And this particular animal companion adds some different and dangerous elements to the story.
So unless you have any other pre-spoiler thoughts, Kipton, you're on.
Pre-spoiler thoughts. You know what? Okay. I love starting at a boarding school. I'll just say that.
Is it because perhaps you went to boarding school?
I think that's probably a large part of it. Yeah. Young ladies of quality is probably one of my favorite lines from this series. And it just keeps coming back because it's written down in iron.
There it is. And when it's written down in iron, you know it's true.
Anyway, now I was thinking about Mistborn.
No, that's where I was going. That's where I was
going. Okay, Kit.
Yeah, okay.
You have a summary, right?
I have a summary. Let's see if I need to re-record this summary by the time that I'm done. Okay. Fittingly, we open the book with the untimely and ultimately fatal birth of Sabriel. Luckily, the Apporson arrives to venture into death and reunite spirit with body. 18 years later, Sabriel is living at Wyverly College in Anselstier, established for young ladies of quality. It's not long before her cozy school life is upset by an unearthly message from her father, who sent his sword and bells to her through death. Sabriel knows this is dire, and sets out at once to rescue and find him. She crosses the perimeter, and then the wall, returning to the old kingdom of her birth, though it's far darker than she ever imagined. Pursued by the dead, Sabriel races for the Abhorson's house one step ahead of a deadly mordicant, where she finds safety, luxury, armor, irascible AIs, and a curious talking cat thing servant called Mogget, collared with the strongest binding she's ever seen. When the dead start constructing a bridge across the river using human slaves, Sabriel summons a flood to protect the house and herself before escaping north on a paperwing. Attacked by Gorkrows, Sabriel calls on the wind to outrun them, but loses control and would have likely died if not for released Mogget breaking the paperwing's descent like Sully coming into the Hudson. Regardless, Sabriel crashes into Hole Hollow, the sacred final resting place of royalty. There she rebinds Mogget when he assaults her in a form of white fire. Later, she finds a naked man magically suspended as a figurehead, freeing him with a breath after a brief inspection. He calls himself Touchstone and doesn't remember much other than failing to save his queen. Unfortunately, he makes a terrible submissive servant. Together, they make their way to Belisaire, first by land and then by sea, where they finally manage some exposition about the Great Charters and Touchstone's tragic past with Caragor, one of the greater dead. Not long after arriving in Belisaire, they concoct the wonderful plan of wading into a trap in the Great Cistern under the palace, where two of the six Great Charterstones already lie cracked and warped. While the dead and Caragor approach their warded position under the earth, Sabriel ventures into death to free her frozen father, only to discover that his soul has little time left, and she must help him wield Estarael to free herself. With an unbound Mogget, the Abhorsen Emeritus faces down Caragor. Sabriel and Touchstone race on to heed his final commands, clinging to life and a kiss as they run to the clearing skies above. Pursued by bandits, Sabriel takes an arrow and Touchstone goes berserk, carrying her to Sanar and Rael, who provide a paper wing and directions to Caragor's body in Ancelstier near Wyverly. They race back, and with only a minor mutiny, Colonel Horis leads a party to assist Sabriel on her quest. They find and unearth Caragor's foul sarcophagus, but the party requires more mages to unseal the binding spell on it. The convoy proceeds with sarcophagus in tow to Wyverly College, where battle is joined all too soon. There is all too much death, and Caragor nearly succeeds, but Sabriel is able to use her binding ring once more to collar Caragor and Mogget combined, who split into two sleeping cats. Thus ends the Battle of Wyverly College, protected by young ladies of quality and the perimeter who swore to keep them safe.
Would you need to re-record that?
That's just so long.
It is very long, but that's okay.
You did miss out on making a reference to Touchstone entering rage.
Oh. He's definitely not a barbarian.
I did enter
Let's
rage.
Re-record that section. Let's re-record that section.
Oh, dear Lord.
Pursued by bandits, Sabriel takes an arrow and Touchstone enters a rage. Editor Kip here. It's funny you're unedited.
Okay, so Hiran Fenn asks, why bells? And in a similar vein, Panda asks, what is your favorite magical elements in the story? So my answer to Hiran Fenn is, why not bells? Because it's fun and it's different. And I think my favorite magical element is probably a Porson's house, like just the whole house in general. I love it.
All the different sendings. Or,
yeah. I like the sendings. I really like the sendings.
Actually, there's a very comic scene with her getting a bath and she's trying to get the sending to leave her alone. And she uses the voice that she's taught in her girls' school about how to class. Deal with servants.
Yep.
That's so great. Anyway.
Look, there's a number of different voices for commanding servants, and mastering each and every one is important in Ancelstier. Yep. Unfortunately, she was never taught how to deal with a servant who's hundreds of years older than her.
Well, and Mogget says something about how they get senile, too. That's why there's all these servants, because they keep having to make new sendings. And the whole concept of sendings, like the guardian sending and the sending at the other end of the gate.
The sendings in Whole Hollow that we didn't quite see.
Yeah. Yep.
But the idea of sendings is also very, to make another Final Fantasy reference, Final Fantasy X, where they're literally called sendings, and one of the jobs of a main character is to help the deceased move on to the next stage, which is very much an abortion thing.
Okay, Spook.
For the first question, in regards to why bells, I just think Garth Nix is a big fan of AC/DC. So, but no, I mean, it kind of makes sense because bells are so closely tied to death, like cathedrals to death, the afterlife because of cathedrals,
exorcisms.
Right. It's so closely tied that it just makes sense that the magic system is built around using bells to command the magic.
Right. It's like, I bind you by book and bell.
Yeah. And I would also agree. I think the house is neat. I am a big fan of very like eclectic houses in fantasy. Like in Harry Potter, the Weasley's house was always very cool to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Howl's Moving Castle is like my favorite Ghibli movie. So I just think it's a really cool idea to have this house just filled to the brim with all these interesting things that even like one book, with how much time we spent in that house, we probably didn't even scratch the surface of what's in there.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
Because like they have a flood summoning room.
That's right.
What other crazy rooms do they have down in the depths? That house is built into the mountainside, into the cliffside.
Yeah.
And however many...
No, it's built on an island.
It's built on an island at the top of a cliff.
Oh, yes. I see what you're saying. Because the waterfall is right on the other side.
Well, yeah. The waterfall like goes around it.
Right. Almost. Exactly. Right.
I will say, I do really like the method in which that they get to the house. With the little stepping stones. I think that's so...
The abhorsen steps.
Yeah, that's so cleverly like thought of. Like, again, it's another... I think that's kind of a theme where it's like, yeah, no, it makes sense. They just have steps that they have to hop across.
Yep.
Because which I find terrifying.
They can't go across running water, so stepping stones it is.
And it's so, like, so simple but so clever, the solutions Garth Nix came up with, the problems he invented, basically. It's fun, yeah.
And stepping stones do not exactly require large amounts of maintenance. Mm-hmm. Especially not when they're slightly magical in the first place.
Like I said, that whole scene where she's stepping across the stones, it, like, I break out into cold sweat every single time because I'm terrified of heights. For me,
it's when she's running up the stairs.
Oh, yeah.
That's the scariest part of that chase sequence for me.
I mean, that's fair.
Oh, when they're really in the cool cave still?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're like in the tunnel and she's running up these stairs exhausted and this thing of fire and brimstone is chasing behind her. And she knows that it's gotten past the door guardian and she's just trying to beat it to the river.
Yeah. It's a well done, scary scene for sure. Yep. The whole thing.
I thought it was, but I didn't really feel like Sabriel was particularly in danger. And maybe that's just a meta thing of just knowing that the main character is not, nothing's going to happen to her just yet. Or at least that she's certainly not going to die.
Yeah, you can't really kill off a character that the book is named after.
Right, to me that's not really a particularly fair critique, but I do wish that the Mordekaiser was like a named character or some sort of spirit just to add a little more lore, because that would have been cool.
It's a free magic creature.
You know, that we like, no.
So we should have an actual name, not a type.
Yeah. Yes. That's nitpicky.
I don't believe that Sabriel would have escaped from something with an actual name.
I don't think free magic creatures have actual names. I don't think they do.
That's fair.
They do. Oh. They just don't tell them. Because to know a name gives you power.
Okay, if you say so, Kit.
Oh, now we're talking about Isekai again?
Well, Nicole, we're talking about Sabriel. We're talking about the hidden names and how Mogget never revealed his hidden name. Just, you can call me Mogget.
Yeah. And that also does bring up another point, but we don't really know who he is yet. We just know he's this thing.
That can be at least a cat and an albino dwarf.
Mm-hmm. Or a big scary shadow creature.
Yeah, the shadow creature. Yeah.
Yeah.
On the magic discussion, no one brought up what I loved with the paper wings as just these fun. it's kind of a, I don't know, like as a kid, I would have loved that. Just the idea of, you can make like a giant paper airplane and that's what you're going to fly in.
That's where you got the idea, I'm sure.
Right. Well, yeah, right. So... like here's your giant paper airplane with the correct words written on it, or words that you have to speak to Airbend or or what have you.
Specifically, whistling.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. The whistling. Sorry. Yes.
And I love that because that relates the magic system of charter marks and bells into a musical notation, like that it's instrument independent. And so it kind of assumes the idea that there's magical frequencies in this land which call on the magic of the charter, and that perhaps each of the bells has some sort of resonant frequency which is linked up with the name of said bell.
And we can't get into spoilers of other books, but there's another book I'm thinking of. That, yeah. And I, yeah, it's so cool. whenever you bring music into magic as a musician, it gives you a lot to think about, and it's just so cool.
And there is a music. It seems like a really good way of dealing with magic, because there is something that is kind of magical about music. Like when you are listening mm-hmm. to something, it can create feelings in you. Mm-hmm. So I think it works well. I could never be a horseman because I can't sing and I can't whistle.
Yeah.
So I'm out.
You know what though? I
can whistle great.
I'm with you where I can't sing or whistle, but going back to what Kip was saying about a lot of it being instrument agnostic, you could probably find something else that's musical that you could learn to call on the right notes or melodies.
I'm wondering how good a tuning fork would work in this magic system. Slide whistle. Yeah, that too.
Any other magical elements that we want to draw attention to?
The magically clear observatory at the top of Abhorson's house is a dream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To just be able to take a little staircase up and be in a place where it feels like you're out in the elements, or at least it looks like you're out in the elements, but you're not. I can imagine Minion and Abhorson spending dark winter night up there.
Yeah.
Cup of cocoa, a white yep. cat curled up on your lap with a good book.
Well, maybe not a good cat, but yeah.
A white cat. It was a good cat. A magically teleporting cat.
Right.
I will say that we've perhaps glossed over one little thing, which is the time difference between Ensel-Sierre and the Old Kingdom. And specifically in this instance, how it means that Sabriel has to go from an entirely different season into the cold of winter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so just emphasizing that seasonal difference and how that season is so much more important in a land without technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just for baseline survival. Her quest is not easy in any way, shape, or form.
And how, like, time. I mean, like, time itself while she's living there is, or at least daylight, it's going to be darker faster than maybe even right. what she was used to at in Celestia.
Right. And that adds a whole sense of urgency when they're traveling around. They're like, okay, it's the middle of winter, so the sun's setting early.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I do like the little joke near the end of the book where it's like the timekeepers are gonna have a hard time with this because they say they're out there for 2 weeks, but they're only out there for 8 days.
Right.
Yep.
Well, and she has a whole almanac, which helps you keep track of where the dates are during
She does. The no one else does.
Yeah. I know, but she does.
Yep. Very useful to her.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah, a main character perk.
An Abhorson perk.
Aren't there others, though, that have it?
I would think so.
Well, she said that a lot of the stuff, she recognized her father's handwriting.
Right, and then others that she said was not her father's
handwriting. Yeah, like previous Abhorsons. So like that seemed to be the personal Abhorson almanac.
I will say, and Kip can cut this if he thinks it's a spoiler, but I don't think it is, is that in the next book, Sabriel commissions almanacs to be printed so that everybody can have an almanac. So, who is your favorite character, and who would you be besties with?
Mogget is my favorite character.
Yeah, Mogget is my favorite character as well.
But I want to be besties with Sinar and Rael.
Okay.
They're the Claire, right?
Yeah. They are the twin Claire.
Yeah, twin Claire, okay.
Yeah, and they are amazing.
They seem quite competent, but also very loving.
Mm-hmm, for sure. I don't know who I'd be besties with.
As far as loving characters go, there's not a ton.
Yeah. I don't really have an answer to that part either. Yeah.
Like Colonel Horace is maybe my other answer for that.
Oh.
I think for the first question, favorite character, it is kind of split between Colonel Horace, because he feels like someone who feels in over his head, and he's like, I don't know what's going on here. And he's just trying to, like, fight with all these politics at his job, which I think is an interesting kind of dynamic, because we see the clear line between the two worlds, but then this is somebody who is constantly dealing with both sides of the line. And I think conceptually it's cool.
And specifically, he keeps dealing with a bureaucracy that refuses to believe any of the things that he says.
Acknowledge it. Yeah.
Yep.
Right.
And I think my second favorite character is Caragor, just because I think he's just this force that just doesn't stop. His only goal in life is to, like, rule. And it's even in the end, he's not done. He's just kind of put away again, basically. And I think that's just kind of cool to have. It's something that really does push the story along, where it's this unstoppable force is constantly coming after you. And Sabriel doesn't know how to deal with it because she's kind of thrown into the story with us, basically.
And I did really like Caragor. He's probably my second favorite after Sabriel. Like, I wish that we saw more of him. Or, like, saw him in more scenes. Just because I really like the idea of him. And I want to know more about, like, his... Or see more about his past. Or see him interacting with more people. But he is a very... He certainly does his job well for the narrative. And it's... And, like,
terrifying.
When he's on screen, you can, like, feel his presence.
And that kind of goes back to what Kipton was saying about how... He does a really good job at sketching those side characters. The thing that stood out to me the most about his character this time was when she's like, I need to go, you know, go see what's happened to Dad. And he's looking at her. He's like, my daughter is your age. I don't know that I would want to send you across the wall knowing what's over there. And it made me think about how when we go to war, it's the very young people who bear the brunt of it.
Mm-hmm.
And,
I would just say that you have no idea who's going to bear the brunt of it.
Well, but you know, the vast majority of soldiers are young people, is what I'm saying. And it kind of made me think about this whole book trilogy kind of makes me think about World War One.
How so?
Just because of the level of technology that's in.
Okay.
And then there's more wars and stuff.
Okay.
Later.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Did you know they're still digging up armaments from World War One in France?
I mean, they're still digging up armaments from Mycenae, so.
Yeah.
So, I don't know how this question is going to go over, but how old were you when you realized that your parents were not just your parents? Does that make sense? Like, they had history, they had jobs, they had flaws, they had... Like, how old were you when you discovered that?
And I'm guessing that this is in reference to mostly, like, when Sabriel meets up. Back up with Worsen in that whole, okay.
Both my parents worked, so pretty early.
Yeah, but you knew, like, she knows her dad has a job, but she doesn't really think about that.
Mm. But she never, like, got to see her dad at work.
True.
And literally only on, like, breaks or vacations.
He'd come down for breaks. She hadn't been into the Old Kingdom since she was, like, 5.
Right.
So she has a pretty unique little viewpoint of her dad as someone who ghostly visits once a month.
I like how the headmistress is like, I'm so glad she's happy that she only sees her dad twice a year, I think is when he physically comes to pay the school. And not knowing about the little monthly meetings, I guess.
Oh, that's funny. Silver was good.
His silver was good. I would say I was probably about 12 when I had that realization that my parent, it was not a pleasant experience either. Because something really bad happened, let's just say. And I was like, oh, so there are people with lives that existed before me. Anyway,
I don't know. I always grew up with stories from my parents, like my dad telling us stories about his childhood and stuff he did. So it's like, as much as I can remember, they've always been more than just my parents, I think.
Well, I did too, but maybe I'm weird, but it didn't seem real. Like,
yeah, I think I agree. I'd probably say high school-ish, just because that's when, at least for me, that's when I started to have more views and experiences that might have been outside of, like, that, like my parents would have had, or stuff like that. It's funny, they felt like they were perpetually in their late 30s/early 40s, just because that's when I think I was just aware of them as like when my more conscious memory starts, if that's not the right phrase, but like for like the longest time, that was just how I viewed them. But as far as the question, I would say probably, yeah, like high school, maybe continue into college, depending on.
Hey, so now we're going to get to the part about the characters that I don't like about this story. Is the love story believable? And the answer I have for that is no.
Absolutely not.
Correct.
I don't even think it was a love story. I don't think it's classified as one.
And honestly, Touchstone's just kind of, I think he's kind of boring, but.
He is.
Like, just as a character.
Except when he turns Fire Engine red.
He's so lame. I don't know. He's kind of a loser.
Although we get to know a little bit too much about it.
You don't want to know about the state of his penis?
I mean,
I think we want to know that Sabriel looked.
Ross asks us, do you think that was a necessary part of the story?
My mental response to that question is, was it necessary for Tolkien to describe the landscape in the way he did? No.
Do we enjoy it
as much nonetheless? He's just describing the landscape. It's realism and it's world building.
So maybe selective realism.
Was it necessary for Victor Hugo to describe landscapes? Maybe. Was it necessary for him to not give a bunch of characters last names? Not.
What I will say about this is this girl has been living at a girls' school since she was 5. She's 19. Oh, yeah. If she sees a naked man, she's going to look. It's just...
I believe that it is realism, and I like what it says about Sabriel's character.
And I mean, in her defense, did she even know he was a living person at the time? I can't remember, because
he was just kind of
a statue to her. And who doesn't look at the statue of David's penis? Like,
it's not a statue.
It's out in David's the open.
Yeah, the whole statue is just David's penis.
If only.
Unless you have like a very different, like,
it's a micro statue that
you can do yourself or something. I think it's totally realistic that she would look. She just
It fits.
It absolutely does fit.
Is there any benefit? Okay. No, but it makes sense.
As somebody whose first experience with seeing a man fully naked was a statue, I'm telling you, I looked. I just did. Okay. Yeah. How do you feel about the ending? Is it satisfying?
Abrupt.
Abrupt?
Yeah, it's quite abrupt. And after a few Hob endings in a row, it seems like a shock.
Yeah, the epilogue isn't really even an epilogue either. It's just the ending of the book. It doesn't really explore what happens after the story. It's just, the book's ended.
It's the
with
speed
her.
Of the story.
Yeah, it's like, here's the actual ending in the epilogue, but we don't get to see kind of what happens next. We just, yeah.
The evil has been defeated. That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
I think it works fine overall. I would have wanted a more drawn out confrontation with Caragor, like at the end of the battle, like when it's just her and Mockett versus Caragor. But so it's funny you mentioned the abruptness. I think that extends to me for a bit of parts of the whole book where I might have been expecting a bigger story is not quite what I'm thinking of, but for everything to feel a little bit bigger. And so I think the ending kind of, it fits with that by that point, what I had recognized was what the book was trying to do. So I can see that in the abruptness, but it was ultimately okay for me because at that point I'd kind of accepted, okay, the story this book is telling is relatively more narrow in scope. And so we're not going, because even though it is book one of a trilogy, like,
it's a simple story with a simple ending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I actually really like the end.
I think it serves its purpose well. It matches the rest of the book.
Yeah, I don't think it's a bad ending. I just think it ends it, and like, boop, we're done.
We have another collar moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really neat. And yes. I like how Roderick or Caragor absorbs Mogget. The one collar kind of splits them into two distinct sleepy cats.
Which is a running issue in the next book. He's spelled with Rana and not Sarath.
Sarenath.
I can imagine.
Sarenath, yeah. So, because he will do something and then his collar will ring and then he goes to sleep.
Okay. We can leave next book stuff till next
spoilers.
Book.
Spoilers. I've only read the first one.
Spoilers! Like, right at the very beginning of the book. We have so much to talk
about in this book.
Anyway, I really like the end. I think it works really well because when you have evil escaping, you kind of need to defeat it fast, I guess is what I would say. I also like that he does a lot with very little, you know, I don't know, it's like 300, 400 pages or something. Mm.
300, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Fast book, an audiobook. It was like 6 hours and change for me.
Like that.
I read it in three hours.
Tim Curry, by the way, is the narrator.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And he does an excellent job.
He does a great job with Mogget.
Yeah, he does.
Great job with Mogget.
Yeah.
Definitely. Is there anything else we want to talk about?
My favorite Mogget line, I see time.
Oh, yeah, when they open the door. Yeah.
Yep.
I wonder if he kind of based Mogget around Garfield's attitude. Because it kind of feels like the way Mogget talks is the way Garfield talks.
Oh, and we never talked about the children's rhyme.
Oh, I didn't write that down either. We also didn't talk about the fact that charter mages can't talk about the charter.
Yeah.
That's until all, out like water. A very convenient plot device, but which was fine. It's fine. Like that's what.
And, like, that's... On the ocean, and then they need to stop talking when they get close and they can't just go back out into the ocean and finish their conversation.
I don't actually have an issue with it. Like those things are just.
There's lots of convenience. She just happens to crash land right next to Touchstone.
Oh, wait, Touchstone.
So she can rescue him.
Although Mogget's the one that slashed the paper wing.
Yeah.
The charter wind brought her there.
He
knew who
he was. On the topic of like the water and the charter, I need to be able to talk about it. I do like that kind of consistency where the free magic or like the dead basically can't cross the river because it's water. But the further out in water you go, the more the hold of the binding where you can't talk about charter magic kind of loosens. I do like that consistency. Mm-hmm. And I think it brings up a parallel to kind of what in the history or the lore of the world caused the charter magic or caused you to not be able to talk about charter magic. So I'm curious how much more that gets talked about in the next books.
I want to know if you can sail to Ensel-Stier.
I think you can.
I'm not sure about that. I don't think you can.
So what would happen when, I mean, if you're...
Because they... Oh, that's a spoiler.
You know, I imagine it. I don't know why you would, like, you wouldn't be able to. It's not like the boat would be, like, you could be in a boat that's not, like...
Technological.
Like steam or electrical or... I mean, unless there's some sort of red.
Like, where do you end up in Ensel-Stier though, or do you end up in like another country if you skirt the wall? If you like, don't get close to the wall.
I'd have to look at the map and.
Well, I do know that one of the crossing points is a lighthouse.
Yes, yes, the wall has an end with the lighthouse.
And we do know that there's other countries in that world.
Yes.
I hope we get more of...
Yeah.
But like, when you overlay one kingdom onto another, or one world onto another, where exactly are the borders? We know the wall is one, but we have no idea where the rest integrates or if it does.
Trying to think if there's any instances. Because
logically, doesn't super work out.
Oh, Panda also asked, what's the difference between charter magic and free magic?
Without going into spoilers.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's hard because it's explained later in the series.
Free magic is the magic that necromancers use and evil free magic sorcerers, and it is opposed to the charter and cannot be used by someone with a charter mark unless they're willing to risk corruption of their mark.
Well, except for the bells. Abhorson's bells.
The bells are free magic and charter magic combined, yes. And Abhorson's bells are. The spells to get between levels of death are also free magic.
Yes. I would say that free magic is lightning and charter magic is like the electrical grid that we have. So it's controlled versus uncontrolled. Mm. That's how I think of it anyway.
It's kind of like wizard versus sorcerer.
Sure.
In a kind of, in the D&D way.
Yeah.
If you say so.
Are there multiple sets? I forget if it's in this book, but does she and Abhorson both have a set of bells in the book? I forget specifically because we see.
No, they share one set of bells.
Okay, all right. Okay.
Yeah. In this book, yeah.
So are there multiple sets of, like, are there, could there be more than one person do it? Like, I know there's only one Abhorson.
Can there be more than one set of Abhorson tools? Yes.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Will there be? I think that's a Raffo.
Well, sure, yeah, that means Raffo, but
the two like special things are the sword and the book.
Okay.
And we know there's kind of two of the sword in a way with touchstone sword being similar to a Abhorson sword.
The Wallmakers made more than one sword.
Yeah, there's lots of magic swords in this story.
Yeah, because isn't there a third one as well in the
there's more than that.
Wall?
There's many, many magic swords. But Touchstone has two. They're just not
a match.
They're not
set.
Named swords.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I really hope we get more just with the bells in general and seeing their different uses, because that would be. But going back to the favorite magic part, that's and like kind of with this with the free and charter magic, that would they present a lot of interesting combinations and potential magical effects.
It is fun to have your protagonist be the only one who's able to officially use a school of like taboo magic.
Which is interesting that it's taboo, given that the Abhorson seems to be both kind of revered and also kind of like people are scared of them somewhat. It's an interesting balance.
They get scared when they see the Abhorson's bandolier because they just think necromancer. They don't think.
But also, just like if there's any sort of necromancer around, either they're there to deal with dead or to raise some dead, and you don't want to be near either.
Fair enough.
True.
So, what do we think about the fact that Abhorson's job is to keep the dead down, and Sabriel has died twice and come back?
Well, fitting.
I think that's a good question.
I always found that very weird.
The charter accepts her, and we're just supposed to deal with that.
I did like the little tropey part at the end where it's like, your job's not done. Go back. As she's like about to die, and I'm like, I just liked it because it's such a trope and it's fun.
Yeah. It hits different when it's magical bloodlines that are possibly at the end.
It's pretty explicit that they're magical bloodlines.
Yeah.
That's part of what the rhyme says. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, who knows if she's got like a long lost third cousin, 3-8 times removed. So she's going to like wake up one day and be like, oh no, I'm that person now.
Yeah. You do get the idea that Abhorson's line is failing in this story. And that there's
every line is
a different line with more
Abhorsons. Royal line, a porcelain line.
The only one.
The Claire seem fine.
Yeah, they're okay.
They seem to be talking quite matter of fact and every day. Like, oh yeah, this is something we do all the time. They sent the flood promptly on schedule.
Yes.
Yesterday, today, tomorrow.
Yep. Tomorrow. It all worked out.
For sure.
I mean, I wonder what kind of magic was involved in them being able to send the flood on time.
Does the ritual just like trigger their premonition and like they actually saw it last week?
Yeah. Okay, I don't think I have anything else for you guys. Do you have anything else for me?
Mm.
Oh, one more thing. Newbies who have not read the next book, what are your predictions for the next book?
I think I'm the only one that can answer this. Because...
Yeah, I've already listened to the next book. I forget a lot of it and we'll need to review it, but I have already listened to it, so I'll hold.
I think we're going to see a merging of the bloodlines. I even though the romance wasn't there, I think the next book is going to have merging of the royal line and the Apporson line, and I think that could create an interesting dynamic.
So you're saying Sabriel and Touchstone are going to have kids?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that's going to introduce an interesting dynamic for carrying two lines at once.
Okay.
Just dealing with like the brunt of having to hold, you know, being the sole responsibility if they have one kid, or if there's multiple kids, them all carrying the lines of these.
The royal line. Yeah.
How old would you think the kids will be?
I don't know. I would like to spend more time with Sabriel as the POV because the book is so short, we don't get to spend a whole lot of time. But I don't know.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us. Please consider supporting the Legendarium on Patreon. Thanks to Craig for loaning us a little corner of your media empire. And for Horizon Brave for starting it all. For Kipton, Spook, and Stormrunner, I'm Little Red Book. Night, y'all.
Night.
Good night.
Yep.